Good evening and welcome to the 26th episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney and I'm your host. I'm a plant-based cardiologist living in Southwest Florida. I'm also an endurance athlete. I'm glad you've joined me this evening. Welcome back if you're a recurrent listener. Before we get started on tonight's interview, which is a fantastic one, I might say, I give you a few updates, what's going on in my world. Training update. I did a local half marathon on Saturday. It's the Port Charlotte first half marathon that they've ever been able to pull off. And it's a little subsection called Harbor Heights. It was for autism. They raised a lot of money. I came away with a PR. And so it was 154 for my PR, which is not too bad. And so I have a new goal in mind to get into the 140s, so that'll be good. My garden update, I've made the planter boxes, and we filled them with dirt this weekend, and I filled the second one with dirt this weekend. And so everything's planted. There's watermelon and cantaloupe and cucumbers and kale, some beans, a couple different kinds of lettuce. We also have tomatoes and peppers on the porch. So things are coming along really well. The arugula and Swiss chard is coming along well. And the latest project is I sprouted sunflower seeds in dirt. And I had bought some sunflower sprouts at our local health food store, and they were delicious. And I saw where they had sunflower seeds to sprout, so I did it. And you just put them on top of the dirt. You put paper towels on top for a couple days with that are watered. Then you take the paper towels off, and 3 days, voila, you have your own sunflower sprouts. They're delicious and nutritious. So in 1 week, you can make your own sprouts, and you know where they came from. So I encourage anybody that has a little planter box and that likes sprouts and nutritious baby greens to give it a shot, to give it a try. As far as cardiology updates, our wellness class is going good. We're still on the third session. I'm also trying to plan a 1-day-long seminar and 3-day-long seminars, probably to take place late summer, early fall. So we're trying to arrange that along with a PharmD in town. Also looking into some 12-week programs locally that if people want to get off their medications and get healthy. We'll do plant-based nutrition instruction, plant-based shopping and menu planning, cooking classes, and also incorporate an exercise program with a personal trainer. So I'm hoping to get that arranged, so maybe we can get that started later in the fall. So if you know anyone in Florida, in the Southwest Florida area that would like to become involved in this project, we'll get you off your medications. Get your cholesterol under control, get you physically fit, get you adjusted to a whole foods, plant-based, low-oil diet, and you can start feeling great again. So that's what's in the works. I'll keep you up to date as those plans get finalized. Tonight, I have a special guest. Her name is Brenda Davis. She's a registered dietitian from Canada. She is the lead nutritionist in a diabetic wellness research project in the Marshall Islands, which started in 2006, and she goes down there periodically, and she's actually getting ready to leave again. Marshall Islands natives have a very high incidence of diabetes, and they're doing a whole nutrition program, exercise, intervention to lower the incidence and treat diabetes down there. She's also worked with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine on cancer guidelines. She's worked with cardiology as far as nutrition programs. She's worked in sports nutrition with organic sports nutrition program. She's the author of 9 books. I highly recommend Becoming Vegan. There's a comprehensive and an express guide. I have a comprehensive one. It'll give you just about everything you need to know about becoming plant-based as far as nutrition goes. She also has a vegetarian and defeating diabetes book and a becoming raw. These are very well written, easy to read, very comprehensive. And she's a wonderful speaker. So you're really going to enjoy the interview tonight. I'm not going to delay things any longer. Without further ado, thank you, Brenda Davis, for joining us. Welcome, Brenda Davis, registered dietitian. I am so glad you'll take my call today. It's a pleasure to get to speak with you. I've downloaded several of your books, including Becoming Raw and The Comprehensive Guide to Becoming Vegan, and they're quite wonderful. I recommend anybody that's taking this way of eating serious, they need to have your book. So welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Jamie. I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So Brenda, one of your stories, I think one of the ways that you kind of your transition into becoming vegan, there was a conversation with a friend that was a deer hunter. I also grew up in West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and my father deer hunted. So that kind of struck a note with me that, you know, those people went out and hunted, and it was kind of an animal control, so to speak, theory. And, the whole philosophy behind that. But it was interesting. So tell me a little bit about your story. You became a dietitian first before you became vegan. Is that correct?
Yes, I did. And I was very, very interested in nutrition in high school and decided that that was really what I wanted for my career, and decided to go into dietetics. And to be really honest with you, I was very interested in plant-based diets, even in high school. It was something that was almost seductive to me. I thought it was just the coolest thing in the world, to the whole idea of living a more compassionate lifestyle and eating plants. But I had never met a real live vegetarian. And it wasn't something that I really thought was possible, even. It just seemed to be so far from anything I had ever come across. But it was intriguing to me.
Yes, I growing up in West Virginia, I did not know a vegan until I came to Florida. And, it was the whole thing. And it's like, how could you ever survive, you know? And then I somehow stumbled on a diet for a new America. And it's like, well, this makes perfect sense. And
It's so similar for me, Jamie, because I actually was a public health dietitian, a community nutritionist. And I had this guy walk into my office one day and throw these books on my desk, and it was Diet for a New America and Challenging Second Opinion, and he said, are these reliable nutrition resources? And I said, I'm not sure, but I think I have reviews of them in my dietetic newsletters. And I looked them up, and the newsletters basically just said these people don't have the credentials to talk about nutrition. So I asked him if he'd leave the books with me. And it wasn't a week or two later that, or maybe it was even a week or two before that, I had the interaction with the deer hunter where, this very dear friend, our best man at our wedding, was going deer hunting, and I was really determined to make him think twice about shooting another deer. And when I kind of criticized him, it was really what he said back to me that changed the course of my life. Because he said, just because you don't have the guts to pull the trigger does not mean you are not responsible for the trigger being pulled every time you buy your piece of meat camouflaged in cellophane in the grocery store. And then he said, at least the animals I eat have had a life. And he said, I doubt you could say the same for the ones sitting on your plate. And he was just so right. And I thought, I need to take responsibility for where the food I'm eating is coming from. And we're so far removed from, the sort of animal agriculture industry that we forget that these are living, feeling beings, and the way that we're raising them has changed dramatically in the last 50 or 60 years. And then I start reading Diet for a New America, and I start ordering journal articles and such, and it was just a revelation. I thought, how can I continue to justify contributing to this kind of pain, suffering, and death in other creatures when I absolutely don't have to? I can eat a diet that's totally nutritionally adequate and perhaps even preferable without contributing to any of this. And so that was just a real revelation. Of course, I was in Northern Ontario, and I was a public health nutritionist teaching about the four food groups. And I was really scared that I was going to have to leave my profession because I wasn't sure how to do my profession and not be promoting meat and dairy products.
Yes, everybody around you. You know, it's bad enough being the crazy plant-based cardiologist, but the crazy plant-based dietitian's even worse.
Exactly.
So I just came across the statistic this morning that people are thinking about maybe 1.5-2% of the American population are vegans, maybe a little bit more vegetarians. It might be a little low, but that's fairly close. The American College of Cardiology, as president, has become plant-based. A lot of the guidelines are starting to tiptoe around the idea that plant-based is a good way to eat.
Jamie, I would go a step further and say they're more than tiptoeing around it. If you really look at the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee report, just very, very recently came out, you'll see that we're more than tiptoeing. As a matter of fact, in that report, Guidelines Advisory Committee actually state very clearly that a diet higher in plant-based foods, such as vegetables, fruits, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds, and lower in calories, and animal-based foods, is more health-promoting. They say that quite strongly, and they are very much promoting more plant, stronger plant-based diet. So we're taking huge leaps in the right direction.
Yeah, I think it does seem to be coming, it's out there. It's out there,
sure.
It's accepted. And then you take it a little bit further. Academy of Nutrition and the kids, the school. Couple talks. I gave talks to the kids, a local high school health class. So I got the 1 o'clock slot after lunch before they leave on an early dismissal to give a talk on, plant-based nutrition and, nutrition in general. And then I talked to the teachers on a health fair type of deal. But, around here, the 70% of the kids get state-supported lunch program, and the food is atrocious. Sausage, yeah. Egg McMuffin type things, pizza, burgers.
Yeah, it's really to me, it's unjustifiable that we're doing that in schools, and it's even more unjustifiable that we're doing it in hospitals, and that we're feeding people who are sick. We know that diet is so strongly tied to our risk of all of these diseases. And yet, we've taken smoking out of hospitals, but we continue to feed people the food that's killing them while they're sick in hospitals. And I'm not sure that's worse than in schools, because it's absolutely paramount that children be fed healthful diets, because that sets them up for a lifetime of dietary choices, and it determines the risk of disease long term. And we really have to start to take this stuff seriously.
So what about Kraft and cheese singles? Are they
Oh, this was quite the deal, because the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics was working with Kraft. They had kind of partnered with Kraft for their Kids Eat Right program, and so Kraft, they approved Kraft putting this Academy logo for the healthy kids, whatever it was, on their Kraft singles. And this created such outrage within the dietetic community. There were petitions and everything else that this morning on my desk, I received a link to this New York Times article saying now that Dietitians Group is negotiating to end the labeling on Kraft Singles. So they're in the process of taking it off. because the pressure from within was so great. And I can't tell you, I'm over the moon with excitement to hear this, because for years, dietitians just sat complacently and said nothing. And we're starting to see dietitians recognizing that this kind of association with the companies that are producing foods that are increasing our risk of disease is not okay. And they're starting to tell our organizations that, no, we don't want you to be aligning with industry at this level. And so this is very exciting news.
Yes, because, conjures up to mind, the little kid sitting after school with the milk mustache and the cheese sandwich,
Absolutely. Absolutely. This isn't even cheese. This is a pasteurized, prepared cheese product. they can't even call it legally. They can't call it cheese. It's a cheese product. So that tells us something. We're trying to lead people away from highly processed foods, not towards them. And so this is an issue, no doubt.
If you go to an Ironman race, they have the big milk campaigns and the big, take your picture with somebody with the milk mustache, and they have some, and they have partnered with Challenged Athletes Foundation, which is a wonderful organization, to sponsor them, but they have some very prominent athletes that are, the got milk and drinking the chocolate milk and all this kind of stuff, and it drives me insane.
Yeah, and it's the same for so many organizations. Think of the cancer organizations and the heart organizations and all of these, groups where often they're doing some sort of fundraising campaign where they're selling, cancer groups selling barbecued hot dogs. You just shake your head and say, or Kentucky Fried Chicken or whatever it is. But it's inexplicable to me. I just don't get how they can think that's okay. But it happens all the time.
Yeah, find a cure for the diabetes. And same thing, they're doing they do some bike rides, and it's just full of cookies, pastries, and donuts. And I just want to scream, the cure is getting away from this stuff. We can put your money back in your pocket. Just don't buy the...
Absolutely. Oh, man.
As a cardiologist, one of the... issues that comes up, typically I deal with an overweight population more often than not. Typically they're diabetic more often than not. And typically none of them eat anything when they come to the office when I, do my little dietary history. And, so it comes down to one of the big things, with Dr. Esselstyn, and, I've spoken with him some as far as the approach. And added oils play such a role, especially in caloric density of foods. But there's such a, olive oil is healthy and coconut oil is healthy. Can you help me put this into perspective?
Yeah, I mean, the way that I look at it is when your house is on fire, you've got a disease, you're wanting to eat the most nutrient-dense diet you can, and you're not wanting to add fuel to the fire. And so when we talk about nutrient density, oils are the least nutrient-dense foods on the planet, meaning that they have the most calories with the fewest nutrients, because there's not a lot of nutrients in oil. It's pure fat with a little vitamin E. And so I certainly don't believe you need to eliminate fat. I think the studies on nuts and seeds and avocados are very, very convincing that these foods are protective. But where oil is concerned, it's another matter. And the way we eat oil is often on a frying pan at high temperatures. We're producing a lot of aldehydes and acrolein and all of these products of oxidation that are really quite damaging to human health. And now, all that having been said, I also think it's very important to recognize that if you look at the blue zones, the healthiest, longest lived people on the planet, the percentage of calories from fat ranges from about 11% to about 38%. They all do very well. What are the common threads we weave through those populations? They're eating generally relatively whole food, unprocessed diet. They do, you know, moderate, constant physical activity. They eat plant-based diets. And so to me, it matters somewhat less in terms of your risk for disease, the percentage of calories coming from macronutrients compared to where those macronutrients are coming from. So people that are getting their macronutrients from whole foods tend to do very well, as opposed to people who are pouring oil all over their food. So I think that's a, you know, a critical thing. And I don't think that it means people can never have a little bit of sesame oil or olive oil for flavor in something, but I really think we need to minimize our use. And I also think that for people who have heart disease, it's, you know, we know the only studies that have ever shown reversal are very low-fat plant-based diets. And so that's very important to recognize as well.
Yeah, and as you know, getting a dietary history is very complex, even in the most well-meaning people. And yeah. People's perception of how much of this stuff that they're consuming, and even realize how much that's in the food that, you know, even like you say, the processed food, that, you know, it adds up. And, you know, and of course they'll come in and say, well, it's, you know, it's okay, doc, because I eat a lot of nuts. And it's like a lot of, you know, it's like, I really don't want a lot of anything for you.
No, and that, you know, with nuts and seeds, most of the research is looking at, you know, 1 to 2 ounces a day and as being sort of an optimal level of intake. You see, and I think people have to remember nuts and seeds, especially nuts, are nature packages them in a very hard shell to protect these very vulnerable essential fats and even the monounsaturated fats. And it would take, if you were living naturally, quite a lot of work to be shelling these things.
Yes.
And I think that's a clue that they need to be consumed in moderate quantities. They don't come shelled. And I think for a lot of people who are wanting to moderate their intake, it's sticking to nuts that are in shells, and you crack open a walnut or two after dinner, or you have a walnut or two that you've just cracked open on your breakfast, is very different than eating mixed nuts by the bowlful. That we shouldn't be doing, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, I remember my grandmother, we had a hickory nut tree, and she would crack those little hickory nuts in the wintertime, you know, unfortunately, to put in some, you know, high-fat, high-sugar dessert, but nevertheless, yeah. It took a long time to get a bunch of nuts cracked.
Absolutely. I do my own walnuts quite often because they grow locally, and it, you know, you have to be doing something like watching a movie or something to get even a pound or two. It takes a long time.
Very, very good. Bone broth, chicken broth heals everything, right?
You know, I can't tell you how much this irritates me. Well, I can. I actually went online when all of this stupid bone broth stuff started hitting the news, and everybody's using bone broth, and I thought, you know, there's, what do we know about this? And so I went online. I went to the place where you search for scientific articles, and I did a couple of PubMed searches. And because basically the claims are that bone broth will heal leaky gut, it'll reduce your joint pain, it'll diminish your cellulite, it'll make your hair shiny, it'll, you know, rid you of your food intolerance. It'll do everything you can imagine. And so I thought, well, wow, I wonder what the scientific research is. And so the first PubMed search I did was I did bone broth and health. And I got 12 articles out of millions of articles. Not one single one of those 12 articles was on the health effects of bone broth. It was on bone broth used in some sort of, you know, petri dish or whatever. So I thought, well, I'll do a second PubMed search, and it was bone broth and risks. Got 10 articles, and only one of those 10 articles was relevant to human health. And I'll tell you what it was. It was hilarious. It was the risk of lead contamination in bone broths. And in this study, they actually, the researchers, looked at bone broth that was made from organic chicken, and they prepared it in several ways, some with the skin and some with the, you know, skin and bone and meat in it, you know, stuck to the bone. And they did it in a variety of ways. And in the end, they found that bone broth actually had significant levels of lead. And in the end, their recommendation was, we recommend that doctors and nutritionists take the risk of lead contamination into consideration before advising their patients about consuming bone broth, because it could be quite dangerous. And so that's all I could find. That was it. So I think that tells us something. I don't think bone broth is the answer to anything.
And along with grass-fed butter in the coffee?
Oh, good heavens. And coconut oil in everything. It's just beyond ridiculous. I guess it's a great way to make money.
It is. It is. You know, it's so sad that, you know, people come into my office and they are truly so confused. Even people that are trying, you know, they just don't know which way to turn. You know, from, you know, I've had people healthy chocolate, you know, of course, the grass-fed butters, the olive oils, the coconut oil, that surely must be good. You know, we should eat a lot. You know, it's always, you need to eat a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, I scratch my head. It's like, no, a lot, you know, it's the marketing. It's just, I guess people are, they just don't think they're going to be lied to as much as they are.
Yeah, well, you know, and I think it all started out, this whole idea that saturated fat, full fat dairy, animal fat was protective or is protective. With two studies, we saw in 2010 the Ceritrino trial, and we saw in 2014 the Choudhury study. And, you know, so these studies basically declared that saturated fat is not associated with increased risk of cardiovascular disease. And so we saw the headlines, butter is back, saturated fats, you know, vindicated, and on all of these things. And if you really look at these studies, there were so many flaws in them. They were really quite misleading. And I think basically what these studies were showing was they were really looking at, if you replace saturated fat with refined carbohydrates, there's no advantage at all. And so I think that was the message of these studies, more than saturated fat is vindicated, because basically they were just showing, you replace, butter or whatever it is, your source of saturated fat, with sugar and white flour, and you're not going to be at an advantage. However, if you replace saturated fat with unsaturated fat, you are at a tremendous advantage. And if you replace saturated fat even with unrefined carbohydrates, you are at an advantage. And you know, it's really interesting, because if you look at both of these both of these studies, either way, the Ceritrino trial, Frank Hu was on that study. The Choudhury study, Francesca Crowe was on that study. And if you talk to any of the, you know, any of the co-authors of these studies, they're the first people to tell you that. If we look at the 2013 lifestyle management guidelines by the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Institute, the Heart Association, you see that we still are recommending no more than 5 to 6% of calories from saturated fat. And that's after, you know, allowing for, looking at all of this data. and the evidence is strong. The strength of the evidence is the highest it can be. So in no way do any of those studies give us any sort of vindication for saturated fat. It's a huge error to think that they have. They haven't.
What's your thoughts on animal protein and the inflammatory effect that it has?
Yeah, well, you know, this is a very, very interesting, interesting area of study to me. And what we know is that there are several things in meat that are inflammatory. So not just the type of fat, but if you look at, the things like NU5GC, for example, which is a very pro-inflammatory molecule, things like things that move up the food chain, like, these persistent organic pollutants that move up the food chain are very pro-inflammatory. So there are a number of things, not just the type of fat and the protein and so forth in meat that can be pro-inflammatory, but many other components as well. Even the carnitine, which gets converted eventually to TMAO, which can be very pro-inflammatory. So all of these things, and we have to recognize that.
And it's not just the change in the way we grow wheat.
No.
The leaky gut and the GMO wheat. It seems to be another source for, again, putting wheat's bad.
And what we know is wheat's bad for people with celiac disease, and we know that, gluten-containing grains are probably an issue for maybe 6% of the population who are somewhere on the spectrum of gluten sensitivity. There are some people now that are, expressing concern about glyphosates that may be sprayed on grains before the grains are consumed. So it may be worthwhile for some individuals to be really seeking out more organic sources if that seems to be an issue, if they seem to be reacting. But generally, there is very, very little evidence against whole grains. We have huge volumes of peer-reviewed evidence that whole grains reduce the risk of not only heart disease, but diabetes, cancers, and so forth. And unfortunately, you've got the grain brain and the wheat belly and all of these books saying grains are poison. And then you've got the whole paleo movement saying grains are unhealthy and you should steer clear of them. But what really concerns me about these kind of claims is that we don't have a population. Paleolithic population was, 1 to 6 million people? Well, we've got 7.5 billion people on the planet right now. If we were all trying to eat a diet that was meat-based, we'd need 15 planets to sustain the current population. We just can't do that. We have to be sensitive to our, ecological considerations, animal considerations, and so forth. And the science just does not support grains as being problematic for humans, in my view.
I agree. A couple different things. There's, there's a company, Beyond Meat.
Yeah.
Which is showing some pretty good promise. It appears to be mainly a pea protein.
Yeah.
And they've heated cold and to get the texture of animal product. Where do you see things like this going, or is it still in the realm of, a transition type food go ahead.
For me, I guess I'm an ethical vegan. Anything that will steer people away from consuming animals is to me a very good thing. Now, from a strictly nutrition perspective, I think we have to recognize that concentrated proteins, we have to extract protein from its original source somehow. And sometimes we use things like hexane to do that job. And not always, but you know, we have to consider this, that we're extracting a concentrated protein, and concentrated protein does tend to increase IGF-1 levels, especially soy protein, but probably any plant protein could do that in large enough quantity. And so I still look at these things as and I don't know if we want to call them transition foods, but more foods that should be consumed in lesser amounts. We want to focus on whole foods. We want to be getting our protein from beans and tofu and tempeh and seeds and whole foods. That's where most of the value is coming from. Now, having some more processed protein products allows for people to take their burger, you know, to the company barbecue and be able to feel comfortable there. And I really think there is a place for these foods. And I think it's an important place. It's nice when your kids are going to scout camp or whatever to be able to have a wiener with all of the other children over the barbecue or over the fire pit. But again, I don't think these foods should be the mainstay or should be really a staple in the diet.
Very good. And, you know, we touched on the hospital and the terrible nutrition there. One of the fights or the pushbacks that I get in the hospital are, you know, typically here in Florida, we have an elderly population and, you know, their albumin is really low. And their albumin's low, their serum albumin's low because they're sick. And so they want to, you know, so they're pushing all this high animal fat, high animal protein on these people. You know, what would be the alternative? If you were going to say, you know, tomorrow we're going to make a menu for hospital patients, you know, I mean, it will do, you know, beans, you know, the traditional sources, whole grains. I mean, you know, can we do this sustainably in a hospital setting where they're, you know, they're also profit driven, you know, what's the push?
Absolutely. You know, if you look at the poorest people on the planet, they tend to eat plant-based diets because they can't afford meat. And so beans and grains are really relatively inexpensive. There's no reason they can't be used in a hospital setting. You know, I spoke at the Suchi International Medical Association in 2008 in Taiwan, and I was absolutely stunned by the food that was being served in the hospital that I was at, because they were actually serving the patients extraordinarily healthy foods. I went into the kitchen, there were bags, huge, like the big black garbage bags, filled with dark greens. And so they were feeding patients, you know, five-grain rice and all kinds of colorful vegetables with a real emphasis on dark leafy greens, tofu, you know, just really, it was completely vegetarian. They weren't feeding the patients in hospital any meat or dairy at all. It was completely plant-based. I was really quite astounded, and I thought, wow, we could really learn something from their example. But there is no reason in the world that we are not spending more on food in hospitals and less on pharmaceuticals, because if we spent more on food, we would need to spend less on pharmaceuticals.
Amen. Maybe that's the message that I need to get across better, because you have to always aim for the pocketbook. And so,
absolutely,
less pharmaceuticals. You know, a better net profit on your DRGs, and maybe that's the way to go.
You know, and the bottom line, I think, is if we put absolutely no priority on nutrition, and we recognize not at all the connection between what people are putting in their mouth and how well they are going to be. And that has, we've got to stop doing that. We've got to start recognizing how critical what we put in our bodies is to how well our bodies function. It's, to me, it's a no-brainer. How can it be otherwise? You know, every single cell of our body is built from what we put in our mouth. It is hugely impactful on our rate of healing, on how our bodies work. And so we can't, we've got to start to recognize that and make it a real priority in our healthcare system. And so that means giving more of the healthcare dollar to that which really matters.
Yeah, you know, it's frustrating. Even, you know, the hospitals are so geared around, you know, the employees a lot are overweight because the cafeteria food is bad. They have fast foods associated with the hospitals. You know, the prizes for whatever Nurses Day or, you know, whatever celebration, pharmacy yeah. week or something like that is always donuts and ice cream socials and all this kind of stuff. And so there's no education anywhere, you know, in the hospital. So if you don't get the front, you know, upfront caregivers to understand this, it's hard to filter it down to educate the patients, you know, because...
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I did fight to get a few vegan options at our local hospital. And, you know, when the clerks go up to take the menus from the patients, they almost, first of all, the vegan options are kind of never really mentioned. And, you know, if I'm in the room, it's like, well, let me help you order, you know. And it's like, what are your vegan options today? And they just start to giggle. You know, like,
you
wouldn't want that, you know, so I'm in the process of it, you know, it's like, okay, so now I want to address the staff that are taking the menus here, you know, I want to educate those people, you know, and I'm trying to get my food, because I don't think if you don't educate the people taking the menus or the people explaining the menus, you're never going to get it to filter down, even the little things that we do have.
And you know, Jamie, one of the steps you might need to take is to not call it the vegan menu, to call it the health, you know, the some sort of health promoting or you know, plant-based therapeutic menu or something that would be viewed in a different light.
Mm-hmm.
And so to call it something that's really positive.
Yes, it's a shame. Yes, I in the office for the most part I refer to it as plant based so that you don't have to go down that road.
Yeah, exactly. And if they just labeled it the disease reversal menu or disease, you know, or therapeutic, you know, chronic disease therapeutic menu or something like that, that would be viewed a little differently.
Okay, I'll go for that as well. Yeah, in the other hospital that I gave a wellness talk on, I didn't realize they were bringing food to it, and they had the green menu, they said, and I go back and they're bringing in chicken and blue cheese, and it's like, oh no.
Now how is that green?
Yeah, well they had some lettuce to put on the side of that, so that was the green.
No.
You know, and it's like no. So I'm actually going back there to speak next week, and it's like, okay, let me help you with what comes out of the kitchen, please.
Wow.
So it should be interesting. Turning a little bit more to, you have a chapter in the book on plant-based and endurance athletes and athletics in general, which is near and dear to my heart. My daughter's actually on the rowing team at West Virginia University, and she's vegan, and she has a terrible day. Well, I take that back. I'll put it one of two ways. A little bit of a difficult time. They're coming around. This is her last year, and actually... They provide dinner for them, I don't know how many nights a week, after practice, and they do have plant-based options, and they are having like green juices, so that's certainly a positive. But boy,
wow.
she's really It's been difficult, you know, on some of the trips, you know, white pasta and, you know, if you can get some steamed vegetables and, you know, it's difficult for, you know, I guess it's been difficult and a good learning experience because she's learned to kind of pack her own supplies, so to speak.
Yes, I can imagine.
But if you turn to, you know, these endurance events that, you know, or first of all, you know, have people, you know, come up. And in my personal experience that I recover much better on a plant-based diet than I ever did when I ate meat. I don't have excessive muscle soreness. I don't have excessive fatigue. My energy is good. You know, I don't have GI issues, especially since I gave up dairy.
It's wonderful.
You know, but people will come up and say, well, I, you know, the first time that they try to transition, you know, some friends will say, well, I tried to transition to this, but I just felt tired. It must be because I need some fish.
Red meat for iron.
I'm not getting enough protein. So can you help address that a little bit as far as, you do mention maybe a little bit more protein in the diet of an endurance athlete.
Oh, absolutely. And so the way that I look at it is, number one, I think athletes, obviously they need a lot of calories often, especially endurance athletes. And what they need to realize is that, you know, 600 or 700 calories of meat and dairy and oil and so forth takes very little small space. It's just a tiny space in your stomach. If you're getting that same number of calories from plant food, your volume is 2-3 times as large. So you have to recognize that you need to be eating more food when you're eating less fat, less you know, meat and less dairy. So larger volume, and you need your serving sizes to be quite a lot more generous. Where protein is concerned, most of us didn't grow up eating tofu and lentils. We grew up eating meat and potatoes. And quite often when people switch to a plant-based diet, they're having pasta and tomato sauce, and that will not provide sufficient protein for anyone, let alone an athlete. And so we do, you know, a lot of people say you don't need to worry about protein as a vegetarian, and I would take exception to that. I think you actually do. And I think that what we need to do is recognize that there are some really important protein sources. And as a vegetarian athlete, if you want to get enough protein, iron, zinc, the trace minerals that are more concentrated in animal products, you need to be including legumes in your diet. And of course, you can use some meat analogs if you want. You've got lots of protein and iron and zinc in the veggie meats as well. But certainly, those foods need to be increased. And so you're wanting to look at, you know, getting at least 1.2 grams of protein per kilogram body weight. And for most people, you can do that quite easily on a plant-based diet. But if you're drinking or using almond milk on your cereal instead of soy milk, almond milk has about a gram per cup of protein, whereas your dairy milk's got, you know, 8 or 9. And so soy milk might have 6 or 7. And so you need to take that into account. So if you're using almond milk, what I would be doing is blending hemp seeds into the milk to make it a thicker, creamier, higher protein milk. And then, you know, put it back in the fridge with the hemp seeds blended in. And if you absolutely can't meet your needs, then you need to consider maybe some, you know, protein supplement like hemp protein or pea protein or something like that. But I really think for most people, you're best getting it from whole foods, and you just need to be ensuring that at every meal you've got some protein-rich alternative. So at breakfast, it's a, you know, a non-dairy milk that's got a good amount of protein and some hemp seeds sprinkled on your into your, you know, whole grain cereal. So you want to be doing something like that. And at lunch and dinner, you know, your lentil soup and your beans and your, you know, your sort of loaves and so forth made with legumes, nuts, and seeds. And tofu and tempeh are wonderful concentrated sources of protein. So you want to be focusing a little bit more on these foods.
Yeah, when my patients come in, and again, I ask them, typically my first question afterward, what did you have for dinner last night? And people that want to lose weight, and it's like, okay. Of course, they'll say they didn't have lunch or they just had a salad. And it's like, well, if that's truly what you're eating, you're not eating near enough. And then I'll tell them, it's like, I just came from lunch and I had a whole can of beans. And I had an avocado on that and I had fresh salsa on that, and then I had a big salad with, other, and they'll look at me and they'll say, I'm 122 pounds. And it's like, you ate what? And it's like, yeah, I said, I eat a lot, and it's like, I eat a blender full of kale in the morning with my bananas and blueberries and, almond milk. I said, that's breakfast number one. And then, then there's the oatmeal, and it's like, you can eat, you need to eat sufficient calories when Absolutely. You're trying to eat this way in order to, to get what you need. And I think but don't you agree though, if you have the beans, I was looking, I got a little bit worried about, the zinc and things, but it's like, if you eat beans and you have the tofu and the tempeh, and the whole grains, you pretty much cover everything if you're getting enough calories, don't you think?
You usually do. And that's to me also where nuts and seeds come in, because seeds are very, very good sources of protein, iron, zinc, and some of the trace minerals that may be a little iffy. And so things like pumpkin seeds and hemp seeds are really wonderful foods. And they actually help enhance the absorption of a lot of the phytochemicals and antioxidants in your food. So you get more out of your food. They're loaded with vitamin E. They're loaded with arginine, which, is converted to nitric oxide and is a potent vasodilator. They just Oh, good. You're back?
Yeah, we're back. So we got nitric oxide is where we left off.
Okay. Oh, sorry. I don't know what happened.
Skype.
Skype. Okay. Okay. So basically what I was saying is with nuts and seeds, you've got, you've got arginine, which is an amino acid that gets converted into nitric oxide and is a potent vasodilator. There are a lot of nutrients of value there, a lot of antioxidant nutrients. These foods are really high on antioxidant score charts. So I think that there's a place for those as well. And certainly if you're eating a really varied, healthy whole food diet with enough legumes and grains and vegetables and fruits and a little bit of nuts and seeds, you're getting everything you need except B12 and possibly vitamin D, usually. And the variety is really so very important. I think that people often don't realize the kind of the value of variety in our foods. It's just amazing the differences even within a single food group, amongst different foods within the food group. Just incredible differences in nutrient value. So if you can include that variety, you'll be protecting yourself further.
Fantastic. And on the move, during these races, I kind of struggle with, I try to eat a whole foods diet and, not a lot of simple sugars, but when it gets down to a race, I'll use dates, typically for the, I'll use some dates. We make rice balls with dates and raisins, to take on the bike, but it gets, down to running, you kind of get stuck with these, the gels and absorption and all this kind of stuff.
And you know what? You do what you have to do, because at that point you need carbs, you need glucose.
Yes.
And so you have to say, well, what's the easiest way for me to get glucose? Now, normally, we're not wanting to eat straight glucose because it does not good things in our body. But when you're running a marathon and you need straight glucose, it's a very, very different ball of wax. So we, certainly, obviously, whenever you're taking in food, it's nice to get nutrients and protective substances with that food. So the idea of, nut and date balls or whatever, getting the dried fruits and nuts and seeds and whatever as your sources of energy is great. But I definitely think there is a place for these very rapidly absorbed sugars in endurance sports.
Very, very good. And then I guess the it makes me feel better. You know, I figure, well, you know, we eat good before, we eat good after, and you know, you do what you have to do during. And of course, we eat for a long time after.
Yeah, I bet.
I was approached, and I read, you know, the section on iodine, and you know, it's in regular iodinized salt. So many people are using sea salt, and that's being promoted as, you know, more gourmet and less bad for you as far as sodium intake. So I wonder, you know, on a plant-based diet, you know, how much iodine deficiency, if people don't eat a lot of the sea vegetables, is it an issue? Do we still get enough processed food that there's, but you said that a lot of times it's not iodinized salt. You know, is there an issue there?
I think there is, depending on where you are in the world. Mm-hmm. So in Europe, there tends to be maybe even more of an issue than there is here, because there's a certain amount of iodine in soil, right? And so vegetables will contain some. But I have definitely seen people who have not gotten enough iodine. And I see it in people eating raw food diets, so they're not eating processed food. They're using Himalayan sea salt and Celtic sea salt and, you know, all of these non-iodized salts, and they don't use seaweed because they don't like it. So they're really not having a good source of iodine in their diet. And that really is an issue. It is really important to make sure that you have a source of iodine. So there's a couple of things that people can do. One is to, if they're using salt, to make sure it's iodized. If you don't want to use iodized salt and really love the flavor of your you know, what we call culinary salts, if you will, these salts aren't, you know, they have trace amounts of minerals, but it's like sugars. The natural sugars have trace amounts of nutrients, but you'd have to eat a cup to get any. You know, that would be a significant percentage of your daily value of any, you know, or your RDA of any nutrient. So they really aren't reasonable sources of any nutrients. So to me, if you want to make sure you're getting enough iodine, you can take iodine drops. You need about 150 micrograms a day. Or if you like, you can use a little bit of dry kelp powder. You can put the kelp powder into your soup or on your salad or whatever. And you don't need much. Even a tenth of a teaspoon a day is enough. It's just a tiny sprinkle. So that's another way of dealing with this. But I really think it is something that is one of the nutrients that deserves consideration on a plant-based diet, especially a whole foods plant-based diet.
Fantastic. Well, this has been an extremely enlightening and interesting chat, and I really do thank you for taking time. What's on your table? I know you travel a lot and speak a lot. What's up next for you?
Well, I actually got back recently from Australia, and that was a really interesting experience. I ended up doing a couple of lectures for dietitians and a couple for CHIP and a couple for the general public, including one where I was pitted against a paleo speaker, which was a lot of fun, as you can imagine.
Oh my.
And then I'm going to, I've got several lectures coming up as well, one set of lectures in Florida, and then after that I'll be probably heading back to the Marshall Islands, where I do work. The Marshall Islands is halfway between Hawaii and Australia, and they have the highest death rates from diabetes in the world. And so I've been working with that population since 2006, trying to help reverse the diabetes epidemic there. Diabetes is an unbelievable epidemic in the Pacific Islands, because they used to live off the land, and now they're living off processed food. And it's just a disaster to health. So working on that project as well, and I'm writing another book on plant-based diets, and I'm working on a couple of dietitian-type projects as well. I'll be speaking at the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, and right now working on an article for Today's Dietitian. So. Lots of little things.
So yeah, you got a few irons in the fire, so to speak.
You bet.
I thank you. I thank you very much for taking time. If Do you have interns involved with your Marshall Islands project, or is that through a university, or how does that go?
Well, we do have students coming on occasion to help us, and we do have dietitians as well who have volunteered to come along and assist. So every so often we're able to bring a few students, which is really wonderful. They've contributed, valuable ideas, and I think it's an experience of a lifetime for a lot of the students as well.
Yeah, what an opportunity.
Yeah.
Well, good luck in your future, and I wish you all the success, and I will continue to be a reader of your books and articles, and
thank you so much, Jamie. I really appreciate the work you're doing, and wish you all the best with it. And I'm encouraged every time I hear of a physician, especially a cardiologist, who has decided to approach health a little bit more from the perspective of the whole person, and including nutrition and food in the mix and putting it at the forefront is just, it's just very encouraging. So thank you.
Well, thank you. And we'll do a salute to more plants and less pills. How about that?
Oh, I like that. Thank you
so
much.
All right. Have a good evening.
Take
thank you.
Care. You too, Jamie. Right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So I hope you enjoyed that interview with Brenda Davis. She is a wealth of knowledge. Again, look into her books, Becoming Vegan, The Comprehensive Guide. It's an excellent source. I think the iodine is a very real good, was a good point to bring out. So much of the sea salts are not iodized. They make other claims that they have other elements in them, but you do want to avoid an iodine deficiency. Nori Reps, another good idea as far as iodine source, which she mentions in her book, and adding some kelp flakes to the salads and things. You can find Brenda Davis at brendadavisrd.com. That's her website. It's very comprehensive, and she has a wonderful bio there, as well as reference to all her books. She's on Twitter at Brenda C. Davis. You can also, find her there. I think that the comment also, the Taiwanese hospitals serving, multi-grain rice and dark green leafy vegetables, something we need to learn about. Our hospitals in this country often have fast foods in the lobby. You see people in the elevators with McDonald's bags. The food is, usually just barely edible and mushy, and so it's no wonder that people don't get better and their immune systems can't fight disease. And, so I really do think we should make a push in hospitals, spend more money on the food and less money on the pharmaceuticals, and everybody wins. The hospitals make more money, the patients get better, and everybody does better all around. So, enough of that. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's podcast. You can find me at jamiedelaney@gmail.com with any questions. I'm still looking for restaurants that might want to talk about their vegan options. Our foodie group is planning to do a pizza night at a local restaurant, so I'll let you know how that goes, doing a plant-based low-oil crust and obviously veggie toppings and no cheese. One last thing, I'd also like to give a shout-out to a person in the hospital that I've been kind of mentoring. Her name is Nora. I won't give her last name because I really didn't ask permission, but she has done very well transitioning to a plant-based diet. She's losing weight. She feels great. She looks great, and she's completed her first half marathon and signed up for her next one with a better time goal in mind. So it's fantastic to see, she's happy, and she's setting a wonderful example for her peers. So, kudos to her. Again, thanks for listening. I'd love to have a nice five-star review on iTunes if you have a chance. If you have any questions, again, please call me. Until then, be plant strong and run long.